remember the movie Mommy Dearest?
What's wire hangers doing in this closet when I told you no wire hangers ever?
Turns out, some people may be genetically predisposed to be better parents than others. If only little Christina Crawford had been able to get her mother tested. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday and it's June 20th. John Hockenberry is away today. This morning, a new study says there's a link between genetics and good parenting. Congress gets ready to vote on expanding wiretapping powers. Operation Malicious Mortgage points fingers at more than 400 alleged wrongdoers in the subprime meltdown. Potential first wives face public scrutiny. Is the 24-hour news cycle that hungry for recipes? And we meet the 2008 U.S. Olympic wrestling team. For the rest of the latest headlines, we go to Femi Okeh. Good morning.
Good morning. The House is expected to approve a surveillance bill today that gives retroactive immunity to telecommunications companies that provided wiretaps to the government after 9/11. Dozens of people who think their conversations were illegally monitored have sued the telecommunications companies. Flood warnings continue in the Midwest. The National Weather Service predicts the Mississippi River will crest at record levels today in a number of communities just north of St. Louis, Missouri. President Bush toured flood-ravaged Iowa yesterday. The United Nations Security Council has voted unanimously to classify rape as a weapon of war. U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice chaired part of the UN session. Rice says the world now recognizes that sexual violence profoundly affects not only the safety of women, but the economic and social stability of their nations. The European Union has lifted limited sanctions against Cuba. EU Representative Benita Ferreira-Waldner says the aim is to encourage President Raúl Castro to liberalize the country.
But I think it's very important because we also want to encourage the changes in Cuba.
The EU's move is seen as a victory for Cuba and puts the EU at odds with United States policy. The FBI is cracking down on mortgage fraud in a new program called Operation Malicious Mortgage. The FBI says they've arrested more than 400 housing developers, real estate agents and lawyers since March, and that their mortgage fraud caseload has doubled in the last 3 years. And on the markets, the Dow stands at 12,063 and the S&P begins at 1342. Adora.
Thank you very much, Femi. And on our minds today is a new study by some Dutch researchers who say genes may be the result of, or I should say genes make for good parent, that genes, certain genes, you can tell if someone is going to be a good parent or not. Do you believe that? Would you get tested? Would you have your parents tested? Patrick Henry Bass, senior editor from Essence, is with us. Would you test your parents?
Good morning, Adora. Because our family union is coming up, I'm going to plead the fifth.
You're going to plead the fifth. How about you? Would like to hear your story, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org. The question being whether or not, do you think there's a gene that can predict whether someone will be a good parent? Also, the spouses of the presidential candidates, are they fair game? Should they face serious public scrutiny, Patrick?
They should face scrutiny. I don't know about serious public scrutiny.
There's lots of debate about that. That's coming up. 877-8-MY-TAKE, mytake@thetakeaway.org. We want to hear from you.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. This morning we're going to start in Zimbabwe, where Zimbabwe's opposition party, Movement for Democratic Change, officials for that party, we understand, are meeting in the capital of Harare, and it's understood that they are considering whether or not to take part in next week's presidential election runoff between President Robert Mugabe and the MDC leader Morgan Tsvangirai. There's been some developments in the last couple of days, and for them, we now go to BBC correspondent Peter Gresta, who is coming to us from South Africa. Peter, can you bring us up to date on the latest?
What we understand from Nelson Chamisa, the MDC spokesman, is that the party hasn't made a decision on whether or not to take part in the runoff election, and it won't announce any decision until Monday at the earliest. The problem for the MDC is really to decide whether it will go ahead with this with the runoff in conditions which are frankly quite bloody at this stage. They say that something like 70 of their members have been murdered. There are something like 200 missing. And there are literally tens of thousands of their supporters who've been forced from their homes in what the MDC and the opposition, and rather the observers, say is a campaign of violence to try and intimidate them out of taking part in the election.
And that would include Morgan Tsvangirai. He has been taken into custody several times and then released. Advocacy groups are saying at this point conditions are not good to hold this runoff.
Yeah, not just advocacy groups, but presidents from right across Africa. We've heard from the presidents of Senegal, of Botswana. We've also heard from the foreign minister of Tanzania, all saying that it is simply impossible for these elections to be considered as free and fair. The problem for the MDC, though, is that if they bow out now, they will then effectively hand victory to President Mugabe by default. And I think what they will do ultimately is decide to take part. They're certainly under some pressure to go ahead with these elections, because ultimately what will happen is that if the election does go ahead, if the observers generally proclaim the election to be fraudulent and the result illegitimate, it will be impossible for the region's presidents, for the region's governments, for the international community to recognize Robert Mugabe as duly elected. And that means that when it comes to the negotiations that must inevitably take place to end this crisis, Robert Mugabe will be forced into a position of negotiating as just another political leader and not as the president of the country.
It certainly is a complicated position for the opposition. This week, for example, the state-run television station decided that it was no longer going to be running any of their political ad. They had a confidant of Morgan Tsvangirai who has also been taken into custody. And is he facing charges of treason?
That's right. We've just had a hearing earlier today, in fact, in which the charges were upheld in the High Court. He's been ordered in remand to reappear in about 2 weeks' time. That's well after the elections are due to take place. And as you say, Morgan Tsvangirai himself has been detained at least five times in the space of a week by police. The party has been banned from running its adverts on state-run media. The government has said that the international media are doing the job for the MDC by supporting it, and therefore the state media has no reason to run those ads. The only way that the MDC can campaign is by getting out into the streets, by physically holding rallies, but even those were banned for a period by the police, who said that they couldn't guarantee the MDC leader's safety in public places, and that there may be assassins lurking in the crowds, and therefore they refused to give permission for those rallies to go ahead. It's been an extraordinarily difficult environment for the MDC, and as I said, pretty well every observer that you speak to, every diplomat that we talk to, comes up with the same verdict, that a free and fair election under those circumstances is simply impossible.
So another chapter and more to come in the days leading up to the runoff election there in Zimbabwe. Peter Gresta from the BBC, many thanks to you.
Pleasure.
Now we're moving on to the markets, where in New York City, the subprime mortgage crisis took a turn as federal investigators started pointing fingers, taking two former Bear Stearns executives into custody.
This is not about mismanagement of a hedge fund investment strategy. It is not about reckless subprime lending practices. It is about premeditated lies to investors and lenders. It's about the defendants prostituting their client trust in order to salvage their personal wealth.
That's Mark Mershon, the head of the New York FBI office, who says that Ralph Chiaffi and Matthew Tanini, former senior hedge fund executives at Bear Stearns, criminally defrauded investors in the run-up to the subprime mortgage crisis. But there are, of course, two sides to the story.
The credit crisis took the whole financial world by surprise. Dozens of banks around the world have lost over $300 billion. Our question is, why is Ralph Chiaffi being charged in this case?
Matt Tanin is innocent. He is being made a scapegoat for a widespread market crisis. and he looks forward to his acquittal.
WNYC senior reporter Bob Henley was at the courthouse and has been covering this story. Bob, can you lay out the accusations the U.S. attorney is making against these two men?
Basically, what happened was over a period of, I guess, starting in 2003, Chiaffi presided over these high-risk hedge funds that were domiciled in the Cayman Islands, and they investors were going to make, you know, double-digit profits on their investment. As things, according to the government, as things started to turn sour in the adjustable rate mortgage around the country and around the world, it's alleged that Chiaffi and Tanin concealed that and misrepresented the nature of what was going on within those funds, which was easy to do, really, when you consider that hedge funds don't have much transparency and the whole operation was down in the Cayman Islands in that sense. And then they would tell people that, listen, we're investing our own money, according to the government, even as they were internally talking with themselves and their colleagues about the demise of the funds.
So this is a case that will potentially open a window into exactly how hedge funds operate. Hedge funds, of course, are less regulated than certain other equity parts of the market.
Well, I guess the thing is that there are hedge funds associations which say it's a fabulous way to make money and that you just, you know, people who invest in it generally have a lot of money laying around, so it's not your widows and orphans. So there is certainly there's a legitimate hedge fund universe. What this will open up the door to is just how vulnerable, though, the whole hedge fund and offshore banking circumstance is, and the lack of transparency in general could, you know, make investors really vulnerable to this kind of alleged fraud.
Why do you think the Chiaffi's attorney points out that subprime mortgage crisis is huge and it's a complicated web of problems? Why are these two guys the first to be prosecuted?
Well, you certainly can. The collapse of these funds were fairly spectacular, anywhere between $1.4 billion and $1.8 billion, depending on what government document you read. There is an underlying circumstance here, which is this religious belief in terms of how we've been administering our economy in unfettered global capitalism. Just let the dollars be free. And that is where we are now. So we have a situation where an ultimate global house of cards, if you will, faulty mortgage-backed securities bundled in non-transparent hedge funds domiciled in the tropical banking netherworld of the Cayman Islands. Can we be surprised it's a problem?
What message do you think is being sent to Wall Street by the feds, and do you think this is just the beginning of cases, prosecutions that they're going to be bringing?
Well, certainly in the indictment, deep in, the prosecutors talk about that Tanin and Chiaffi, together with others, that's the part you're very scared about if you used to work with them. So there's a lot of unnamed people. There's also some missing evidence. Evidently, there's a tablet computer and some other things in a notebook that just, well, they're gone. So we're going to see much more here. Of course, there's Operation Malicious Mortgage. That was rolled out in Washington where 400-some-odd local real estate people, because remember, mortgages and mortgage lenders, that's really an unregulated frontier. Mm-hmm. They were rounded up yesterday. It reminds me very much, I'll date myself here, like Don Knotts, you know, in Mayberry, you know, the idea of the overzealous deputy sheriff arriving after the crime has been committed. You could make an argument that the federal government was willfully asleep at the switch and then said, oh, there's a problem. And so that's the thing these defense lawyers are going to be saying. They're going to be saying, listen, these are the rules of the road. This is what the government created by either malfeasance or maybe even it was a deliberate policy. We'll have to see.
So more to come on this for sure. And also, of course, the smoking email prosecutors say prove that these two men were involved in conspiring to fraudulently get people to invest in hedge funds.
Absolutely. The thing here, the takeaway, so to speak, no pun intended, is that do not write an email, no matter how powerful you are, something you don't want to read on the front page of the New York Times.
Good takeaway there. Bob Henley, senior reporter for WNYC. Many thanks to you.
Thanks.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253. Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's now less than 2 months to go until the 2008 Olympics. That means all the teams, including the wrestlers, have exactly 49 days to get ready. This year, the U.S. is sending an incredibly diverse group of wrestlers, African-Americans, Asians, Hispanics, women and men, a high schooler, one of the youngest athletes, the smallest Olympian who is fierce on the mat. The wrestling team is in New York on a special mission. We'll get to that in a moment. But first, Coach Lee Camp, how many goals are you going to bring home?
Well, as a coach, we like to be very positive. I think every athlete has the opportunity to win a gold. I mean, who'd ever think a high school senior would be on the Olympic team? So,
and this is a fierce team you have.
Yes, we have very capable athletes in every weight class.
Also joining us, Clarissa Chun. Congratulations, you are on the team.
Yay, thank you. I'm very excited for this.
And not only are you on the team, but you're also making another record, which is you are, I understand, the smallest Olympian at the Games, 4'11 and 105 pounds.
Yes.
How did you get into wrestling?
I started judo when I was 7 and transitioned my way into it my junior year in high school, so loved it ever since.
And yeah. It's interesting because I think, Coach, the perception of high school wrestling particularly is of, in the Midwest, young white males. It is mostly men. It's 250,000 in the country in high school wrestling and 5,000 women. So, again, you are among a very special group. But there are certainly lots of children and teenagers, young people of color who are getting into the wrestling game.
Absolutely. Wrestling is a big grassroots sport, and it's one of a sport that doesn't require very much to get into, really. I mean, if you put two little boys in a room, 5 years old, before long they're going to be wrestling, you know, on the floor. So it's just one of those things where organized programs at the kids' level is pretty big, actually.
And so, has there been a real effort to reach out and say communities that haven't necessarily had a history of wrestling?
Yes, there is. There's a program called Beat the Streets in New York City. And that program is designed to attract kids, inner-city kids, who might not ever be exposed to the sport of wrestling. And really, the program is pretty simple. They're putting a wrestling mat, in all the inner-city schools and organizing programs through the physical education program to get the kids on the mat and teach them basic skills in wrestling.
And Clarissa, you said you've loved it ever since. What is it about that you love? And I should note, actually, this is your second time on the Olympic team. You were a backup last time.
Yes, I was an alternate. I think I just like the competitiveness, the combat of it all, and just that, you know, wrestling is evolving. You know, there's so many ways that you could use your technique.
You look like you're in fantastic shape, by the way. I wish everyone could see you about now. So how do you get ready for the Olympics, 49 days to go?
Just a lot of training, doing what I've been doing, eating right, and just mentally preparing myself for this big day, you know? So
let's talk about where you're going. You're going to Beijing, China. And for you, Clarissa, there's a personal meaning to this trip.
Yes, I'm half Chinese, half Japanese, and to be able to bring back the gold to America, being of a Chinese descent and it being in China, would mean a great deal. You know, my ancestors are from China. And
what does your family think about this?
It's a great opportunity. They've been like supporting me since day one, you know, and for me to finally make the team and go to China and represent my Chinese heritage in China, they're very emotional about it.
And Coach, you have a story here too, which is you were on the 1980 Olympic wrestling team. Were you the only African American then?
No, there were several on the team, actually.
But you didn't end up going because the U.S. boycotted the Olympics, and now here you're going as a coach. How did it make you feel when they were talking? There was some talk earlier in the year about potentially boycotting the China Olympics.
Well, it obviously brought back some very unpleasant memories. When I was an athlete back in 1980, I was I was favored to win the gold, and that was the goal of my whole athletic career. And so when I heard talk about it happening possibly again, it just brought back those bad memories. And obviously 1980 was really not a good decision. And I think most people realize that now. And we as athletes had no choice in the matter. And our government, our president made the decision, and we had to stick by it.
Does it create extra excitement to see all these young people who are going to be going for gold this year?
Oh, absolutely. And it's brought me full circle. It's brought me back into wrestling. It's given me a chance to help other athletes achieve their goal, their dream of winning an Olympic medal. So it's great.
So you're here in New York. Tell me about this mission that you're on. What's it called, and what are you trying to accomplish?
It's called feelthedream.org, or Feel the Dream, and you can go to the website, feelthedream.org. And it's a fundraiser to help get the Olympians, families, and friends out to support us, you know, and be there at the Beijing Olympic Games, just because it's so expensive to attend the Games.
We will shoot both the best of luck. Lee Camp, one of the coaches of the U.S. Olympic wrestling team, and Clarissa Chan, a 26-year-old Asian-American freestyle wrestler from Hawaii. Thank you both. Very inspirational, Patrick. Henry Bass, senior editor of Essence, with us today.
It was, and I bet you didn't know that I was the other African-American on that wrestling team in 1980, going for the gold.
You were not.
I was not.
Now we're going to turn to Femi Okeh for more headlines. Femi.
Hello there. It is just coming up to 28 minutes past the hour. The United Nations Security Council votes unanimously to classify rape as a weapon of war. A suicide bomb attack killed 10 civilians in southern Afghanistan earlier on this morning. And we're also following some breaking news on Zimbabwe. The opposition party there, the Movement for Democratic Change, are supposed to be in a runoff election next Friday with President Robert Mugabe. The opposition party is saying that they may well pull out of that election. Earlier we spoke to the BBC correspondent Peter Grester, who's based in Johannesburg, South Africa.
70 of their members have been murdered. There are something like 200 missing, and there are literally tens of thousands of their supporters who've been forced from their homes in what the MDC and the opposition, and rather the observers, say is a campaign of violence to try and intimidate them out of taking part in the election.
That was Peter Grester talking about the violence against the Movement for Democratic Change. The party will make their decision, Peter says, on Monday. The European Union is also considering fresh sanctions against Zimbabwe's authorities over the election violence in the country. Former White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan is on the House Judiciary leg of his book tour today. He's testifying under oath about whether Vice President Dick Cheney was involved in leaking CIA operative Valerie Plame's identity. South Carolina faces a lawsuit for its plans to offer an I Believe license plate. A group that advocates separation of church and state says the plate endorses Christianity. And that's your news. Patrick, you know, you saw Clarissa in the studio. She's tiny, isn't she? She's 4'11", Olympic wrestler. Do you think I could take her?
Bring it on.
Yeah. You take Lee. See, we're brave now that they've left the studio. You take Lee, and I'll take 105 pounds, Clarissa.
I wish you
it's
both
a deal.
Good luck on that.
Yeah. You Thank can see you. Us on the podium. August.
In August.
In Beijing.
You know what? I'll be looking for both of you, actually.
I'm taking leave now. I'm filing it.
Thank you, Bobby.
You're very welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its American Worker Initiative. More at rockfound.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Father's Day, a short film about a woman whose father left her when she was a child, and her daughter, who now wants to meet her estranged grandfather, if he lives long enough. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Friday, June 20th, and John Hockenberry has the day off. And we have a question for you, which is, do you believe that there may be a gene that you have that will determine whether or not you're a good parent? Do you think so? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Perhaps you'd like to get tested or have one of your parents tested. Let us know. We're asking because this morning we have a study that's sure to kick up some controversy or at least get a good debate started. Dutch researchers say they have found a link between genetics and good parenting skills. Their study points to oxytocin, a hormone, which according to writer Jonah Lehr, we're going to see a lot of in the headlines. Jonah is the author of Proust Was a Neuroscientist. Jonah, please explain what is oxytocin and why are Dutch researchers saying it links, there may be a link from it to good parenting behavior?
Oxytocin is a hormone that's also a neurotransmitter in the brain, so it's used by neurons to communicate with each other. And the reason these researchers looked at these genes which encode parts of the oxytocin system in the brain is that oxytocin has long been recognized as a crucial hormone for maternal bonding. So, for example, when you inject oxytocin into prairie voles, they'll immediately...
Into who?
Prairie voles, a funny-looking kind of creature that lives underground. And you inject it into female prairie voles, they'll immediately fall in love with the first male prairie vole they see. If human subjects inhale a nasal spray of oxytocin, they become much more generous during various experimental games people can play, like the ultimatum game. Their offers increase by 80%. So it's released in vast quantities during birth and breastfeeding. So it's long been recognized as the hormone that plays a very important role in kind of mammalian bonding and drawing people together and probably helping people fall in love, even prairie voles.
Sounds like a good hormone. Does it have anything to do with runner's high or other good feelings when you're doing some type of activity?
It's not like those endorphins. It's not like adrenaline or something like that. It seems to be specific to social interactions. So, for example, you know, they've also done lots of experiments with various kinds of rodents, rats. They've shown the same thing. You inject this thing, it's like love potion number 9.
Now, that's a provocative conclusion. How confident are they, though, that the levels, and it is about the levels, right, that you have in your system might dictate how good of a parent you are?
Well, so what this study in the Netherlands looked at, they looked at 159 middle-class mothers with 2-year-old sons, and they found that women who have a variant of a gene which encodes a part of the oxytocin system, and this variant of the gene is known to make the oxytocin system a little less effective, a little less efficient in the brain. They seem to be less sensitive to their kids. So on a variety of measures, for example, how quickly they respond to their child when he's crying, to how often they kiss their child, they seemed a little less sensitive, a little less nurturing. And this seemed to correlate pretty well with women who had this variant of the gene.
This is Patrick Bass here. So you're talking about social interaction, you know, a lot. But what if you're a misanthrope?
What if you're
a loner?
People do believe that oxytocin might play a role in sociopaths and in kind of extreme forms of the behavior. So you know, this seems to be, I think it's also very important to note that clearly the model we have now is vastly oversimplified. I think there's a long history in neuroscience of people latching onto a chemical and saying, here's the chemical of love, here's the chemical of social bonding. So I've no doubt the story will get much more complicated. But right now, I think oxytocin really is a nice model to study everything from what causes prairie voles to fall in love to what might be wrong in the brain of a sociopath. So it really is a nice window right now into these very complicated things like social interactions.
Exactly, which is why that we should take this study with a bit of caution because, as you know, I mean, at one point it was dopamine and then it was serotonin, and we hear about these hormones that are heralded as the end-all, be-all. But scientists in this case are really just beginning to investigate and understand what oxytocin does, right?
Absolutely. You know, there kind of is a history of neurotransmitter of the month, and oxytocin is the hot, hip, new neurotransmitter. And I think it is very important to take it with a grain of salt. That said, I think the study, you know, the findings are statistically significant, and it is an interesting way to study something as complicated as parenting. So I think even these researchers would never argue that oxytocin is the determining factor, the single causal factor that makes you a good mother, a sensitive mother, or a cold mother. But this might be one of the, you know, hundreds of variables that comes into play.
Jonah, of course, as I predicted at the beginning of this segment, controversy and at least or at least a good debate, because already we've had one of our listeners have a response to it. Let's listen.
Good morning, Adora. This is David from Putnam. I really can't buy the good genes makes good parents. Good parenting comes in basic forms. I mean, there's only so much you can do to be a good parent. After that, it's up to the genetics. And who hasn't seen a family, my own, for example, where you have three boys, two who grow up perfect and one who's a black sheep? That'd be me. Take care. Bye.
He's calling himself a black sheep. I think
he's
everyone,
Dutch.
Everyone has an opinion on this, right, Jonah?
Oh, I have no doubt. You know, we all had parents. We all had mothers. I think there is something difficult with swallowing the idea that there are these genes, these impersonal things in our brain that somehow shape these aspects of behavior that we consider so fundamental, what kind of parent we are, what kind of child we are, what kind of person we are. So there is something inherently troubling about the idea that this gene which controls some squirts of neurotransmitter in our cortex ultimately determines what kind of parent we're going to be. So that is a troubling idea. I think it erodes lots of fundamental concepts we carry around about human beings.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is one of the things science does.
Jonah Lehrer, science writer and author of Proust Was a Neuroscientist. Thank you. Now time for more headlines from Femi Oke. Femi?
21 minutes to the hour. It is very hot in Southern California. Floods continue in the Midwest. A war funding bill passes the House and heads to the Senate. And South Korean President Lee Myung-bak announced the replacement of 7 top aides today in the midst of public outcry over government plans to start up U.S. beef imports. Now to some stories in more detail. Parents of children killed in a school collapse during China's earthquake last month are again demanding answers from the government about why the poorly built school collapsed. They staged a sit-in at the school today. Police detained at least 2 foreign correspondents during the protest. The IRS says it's still trying to reach some 5 million Americans, primarily mostly seniors and veterans, who have not filed their tax returns and they're needed to qualify for stimulus checks. And finally, French President Nicolas Sarkozy is asking the United Nations to award French cuisine a UN heritage status. Head chef Guy Savoie from Paris is part of the lobby to get French food recognised. Chef Savoie is in no doubt that French cuisine is the best.
French cuisine is a nouvelle cuisine, is a terroir cuisine, is a family cuisine, is a pastry cuisine, is bakery cuisine, is charcuterie cuisine, is cheese cuisine, is wine cuisine.
Oh, yes, okay. We just interrupt Chef Savoie just then. A parliamentary fact-finding commission is hearing arguments from top chefs and specialists about France's candidacy for the status, and they have 1 year to apply for UNESCO status for French food.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
Fascinating.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's June 20th and it's Friday, and Patrick Henry Bass, senior editor at Essence Magazine, is with us today. And Patrick, it's movie day, right?
Yes.
Movie day. So if you're headed out this weekend, give us a call. Let us know what you saw. If you liked us, give us your review at 877-8-MY-TAKE. So what's on this weekend? Well, I think it looks like the Battle of the Funny Guy blockbusters, and we have a preview, not just any kind of preview. Patrick, can you say we have the mother of all trailers?
We have the mother of all trailers.
There has always been a delicate balance between chaos and control.
Sudaisy!
Now can I interest you in a book?
Now, with that balance threatened, it's time to turn to one man.
I am His Holiness, the Guru Pitka.
The first theatrical motion picture based on the American Girl books.
Oh, I'm so happy! I'm so happy! Yay!
Mike Myers.
Missed it by that much.
You are a midget.
Justin Timberlake is Kid Kittredge.
Kick. Did someone order the special Quebec pizza?
And a monkey?
Wow. That actually makes sense.
Okay, so that's Get Smart with Steve Carell, The Love Guru with Mike Myers, and then plus the Kit Kittredge movie, along with Brick Lane, which is a movie based on a novel. What's the buzz? What are you going to go see?
Well, it's going to be a tough one, you know, passing up the blood and gore of Kit Kittredge and American Girl, you know, quite violent movie.
Right. But about a young woman who likes to write.
Absolutely. But I think I'm going to go see Get Smart.
Because
it's, I love that show growing up. It was, you know, it was a 60s Cold War spy spoof. Buck Henry was the writer. I loved, I loved the witty dialogue, you know, the fast flash cuts. I'm not sure going into this that I'm going to love it, but it's great escapist entertainment because I love Steve Carell in The Office. And I liked Anne Hathaway in The Devil Wears Prada. I think she's on a good role in terms of her career. So it's going to be interesting
and
to see.
And also,
how they
we should add that Dwayne The Rock Johnson's in it and Alan Arkin.
And that makes it Alan Arkin won an Academy Award.
So you're going to give us a call and let us know what you think of that movie.
Yeah, Alan Arkin won an Academy Award for Little Miss Sunshine. Yeah, so it's a good stellar cast.
And today we're also talking about a study from the Dutch. Researchers there saying that they believe there's a gene, oxytocin, which may predict whether or not you're a good parent. Some people are buying it, some people aren't. This is what some of our listeners had to say.
Good morning. My name's Chris Weber. I'm calling from New Jersey. Good parenting gene? Give it to me. I'll exhume both my parents' bodies and make sure it was them and not me. Later.
Hi, I'm calling from Manhattan. My name is Emily. I'm an NYC member. I wanted to say I'm a parent of two kids, and I highly object to the model of the vole injected with oxytocin. That might be relevant if you're studying voles, but if the subject is human beings, there's no point in injecting animals with human hormones or with hormones to allegedly study human behavior.
Interesting.
Yeah, actually, I think I now understand that where we got Muskrat Love, the song from.
The Muskrat Love.
Yeah, Captain.
Well, this is the question. Researchers are really, as Jonah Lehrer told us at the very beginning of their research, what do you think? 877-8-MY-TAKE. Genes predict parenthood skills?
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I do not think that spouses and family members, I'll broaden it out, are fair game. And I'm not saying that because of either treatment on either side. I just think that politics, there has to be some decorum left in politics and in American journalism as well.
That is Cindy McCain, wife of presumed Republican presidential candidate John McCain on CNN last night. And that's a big question. What difference does it make the spouse of the individual candidates who are running for president? It's not clear, but certainly in the last couple of days and weeks, we've been seeing growing scrutiny of Cindy McCain and Michelle Obama. Patrick Henry Bass is here with us, and joining me now is Connie Schultz, columnist for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, wife of U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown, and author of the book, and his lovely wife, a memoir from The Woman Beside the Man. Good morning, Connie. And we know you've been there. What's it like to be the candidate's wife and have the cameras turned your way?
Well, I don't think it's on the same level as a national race because I was not auditioning for First Lady. I think Cindy McCain is mistaken. I understand why she feels the way she does, but I do think the wives deserve the scrutiny because they are, in effect, auditioning to represent our country, too. I did think it was an interesting experience, hence the title of my book. I had taken a leave of absence from my column writing to avoid a conflict of interest, and I couldn't quite believe how quickly I felt that I was dissolving before my eyes, and it didn't even have a name a lot of the times. I really was introduced simply as Sherrod's lovely wife, which was just astonishing to me and fairly annoying to some of my friends. But it was a real experience for me, and I came to understand that if you are married to someone who is going to run for higher office, and certainly the Senate is considered higher office,
certainly.
You give up much of your rights to privacy, you are no longer a private citizen. And I just think that argument's already over with. The conversation to be had is what is fair in terms of coverage and what is not.
Do you think that Michelle Obama is getting fair treatment?
No. And I don't think we can separate Michelle Obama's gender from Michelle Obama's race. It's been interesting to me to be participating in some of these discussions on television and radio and also listening to so many of them. There have been strong women before her now. Hillary Clinton certainly was a strong spouse.
Teresa Hines, Elizabeth Edwards,
yes.
Elizabeth Dole in 96.
Right.
Betty Ford.
Exactly. But the difference, of course, is that none of them were African American. And Michelle Obama is such a strong, articulate woman. And I'm sure you both have seen the ad that came out of Tennessee, online video of Michelle Obama with her comment about being really proud to be American, which they deleted as they kept spinning. You know, they kept showing it over and over again, and then having, not coincidentally, all white Americans except for one Hispanic American talking about how they've always been proud of their country.
So you've got gender issues as well as race issues in this particular presidential election. We're going to get to that in 1 second, but let's go back to a point you made a second ago about you felt like you were dissolving as you were moving forward with your husband's campaign. Let's listen to a bit of Michelle Obama on The View yesterday.
I stopped wearing pantyhose a long time ago because it was painful.
Yeah.
And they'd always rip. And I'm 5'11", so I'm tall. Nothing really fit.
And nobody wants to
do that. So I put them on, you rip them. Mm-hmm. It's inconvenient.
Okay, so here you have a Harvard-educated lawyer who up until recently was the breadwinner, essentially, for the family. She made certainly a lot more money than Barack Obama did. Talking about pantyhose on national television, what do you make of that?
Not only that, for those who were watching the show, you couldn't help but notice that the camera zoomed in under the table to show her legs twice.
And I thought they were Sherry Shepherd's legs that they showed, actually.
Oh, one of the co-hosts of The View.
Yeah.
And to me, that was a major groaning moment. I watched it. I just felt bad for Michelle Obama because, as you just pointed out, she's highly educated. She's a very smart woman. But I also understand her fear. And her fear, in part, she's devoted to her husband, and she does not want to do anything to jeopardize his race. And when you are the candidate's spouse, and I certainly identify with being someone with strong opinions. I can remember every time Barack Obama came into Ohio in 2006 to campaign for Sherrod, it was only when I would make some kind of, I'd be backstage and I'd shoot off a comment or something, and he'd turn to me and say, "You would love Michelle," because he thought we had a lot in common. But I also understand, being a woman who had been paid to give her opinion and having a book of my columns come out in the middle of the race. Random House published the first book right in the middle of the, which they should have. We had already agreed to it.
And you were trying to sell books. I mean, let's be honest.
Well, it had already been scheduled. We had already set the schedule before Sherrod ever announced running for the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And the point of that being, though, that I was really, there were moments of anxiety, worrying, because the consultants at first were worried, well, what of Connie's opinions are they going to use to hurt Sherrod? As it turned out, they didn't do that. And I think the reason his opponent didn't do that is they knew that women in Ohio weren't going to put up with it. I think we're going to see the same kind of backlash if that happens with Michelle Obama to any great length in the country.
But you're really pointing out something important, which is we started with Cindy McCain talking about family members and spouses should be off limits. However, they also put themselves forward. Michelle Obama chose to go on The View.
Right.
Cindy McCain has chosen to be interviewed by Vogue magazine. So can you have it both ways? How do you create the boundary there?
You really can't have it both ways. I mean, that would be the point. And both of them know that they have put themselves out there. They are actively campaigning for their husbands. Cindy McCain is granting interviews just as Michelle Obama is. And as I said, that argument, done, over. It's already behind you. You have decided that you are in the race with your husband, which I can't imagine. I mean, remember Howard Dean when his wife wasn't campaigning for him? And remember how all these questions kept arising from the media. How much does she really love her husband? Does she really want her husband to run? I mean, there really is a no-win here in terms of it has to be a joint effort by spouse and the candidate, because once the candidate's in, you are in whether you want to be or not.
Connie Schultz, columnist for the Cleveland Plain Dealer and author of And His Lovely Wife, a memoir from the woman beside the man. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're moving on to Canada now, where authorities have a mystery on their hands off the shores of Vancouver, which involves police, ocean current experts, and feet. This week, the latest sneaker-clad foot washed up on the shores, the fifth in a year for right feet and one left foot. Patricia Murphy, who's been covering and following this story for KUOW Public Radio in Seattle. Good morning. Very early there. Police have a real puzzle on their hands, don't they?
Oh, they certainly do. And the latest news on this is that a DNA link has been ruled out between three of the feet and two of the four crash victims, plane crash victims, who they thought these may have been connected to. So hopes are fading for those family members that those feet could have belonged to their relatives.
Patricia,
so now the theories abound about what could possibly be happening here.
Let's start at the beginning. A foot washed up, not a severed foot, but they're calling it a disarticulated foot. When and why is that distinction important?
Well, the theories around the severed feet certainly move towards the serial killer, you know, mortician prank, medical school prank, and the RCMP has really asked people to stop using the severed foot theory because the feet have in fact become disarticulated. The bodies have been in the water for so long that the feet are actually becoming separated from the bodies rather than somebody using something like, say, a bone saw to cut them off.
What's the leading theory about where they've come from? Are there any missing people from boats having capsized or planes having crashed in the water in that region?
Well, right now, there are lots of theories about where these feet may have come from. A tidal expert thinks that perhaps these feet belong to people who have disappeared while out on the water. How many boats go down, you know, that people don't know about, that the Coast Guard isn't notified about? The RCMP has 2,300 missing person reports.
RCMP, right now. What does that stand for?
Royal Canadian Mounted Police.
Okay. They have how many people? Sorry.
Oh, 2,300 missing persons reports that they can go through, but certainly right now a lot of the theories are leaning towards a plane crash, a boat that has gone down that perhaps has been shifted under the water and released these body parts.
The mystery continues. Patricia Murphy, whose husband calls her Morticia because of the stories that she covers, reporter for Puget Sound Public Radio in Seattle. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much.
That's one big puzzle. Patrick Henry Bass, senior editor at Essence, is with us.
Sounds like a Kay Scarpetta novel, right?
It does indeed. It certainly does. We want you folks to keep your responses coming. We're asking today, should the wives of presidential candidates be facing such harsh scrutiny from the media, Patrick? And you think right now Michelle Obama, she's enthralling to the press.
Well, she's intriguing, you know. And, you know, there's a lot about Cindy McCain that we don't know, like her income taxes, you know. No one is really talking about her drug addiction. You know, her role in the Keating Five. I mean, there's some there. But Michelle Obama is just innuendo and whether or not she's patriotic.
Well, we have many days and weeks to come, so we'll certainly be hearing lots more about them. We're still getting responses on whether there are special genes for nurturing parents. Rick Evans writes to us, nurturing, attending to crying. One parent's nurturing could be another parent's pampering. Is it possible Dutch researchers have uncovered a brat spoiling gene? And we also got a note yesterday about yesterday's segment on doctors and patients and end of life. Anne wanted to know where she could read that study. And it's the American Society of Clinical Oncology, and we have a link on our website. We'd like to hear from you about your movies you're going to see this weekend. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway,